Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research and uncover the stories behind groundbreaking discoveries. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host, Jane.
Hello, everyone. In this episode, we're going to be exploring a fascinating research paper that delves into the world of municipal bonds and the impact of fiduciary duty on municipal advisors.
The title of the paper we'll be discussing today is Fiduciary Duty in the Municipal Bonds Market, authored by Baridi Malakar.
This paper investigates a crucial issue in the municipal bond market, the potential conflicts of interest between municipal issuers and their advisors. Municipal bonds are used by state and local governments to finance various infrastructure and public utility projects, and they often rely on the expertise of advisors to help them navigate the complexities of the bond issuance process.
However, the relationship between issuers and advisors can be fraught with misaligned incentives, decentralized information, and missing internal controls. Advisors may not always act in the best interest of the bond issuers, leading to what the researchers call a principal-agent problem.
To address this issue, the SEC imposed a fiduciary duty on municipal advisors through the Municipal Advisor Rule, which became effective in July 2014. The researchers wanted to understand how this regulatory change affected bond yields and advising fees.
They used a clever difference in differences approach to tease out the causal impact of the fiduciary duty rule. The key idea is that the principal agent problem is likely more pronounced in negotiated bond sales, where issuers and advisors work closely together, compared to competitive bond auctions, where the price discovery process is more transparent.
By comparing the offering yields of negotiated bonds, which are the treated group, to the yields of competitively bid bonds, the control group, the researchers were able to isolate the effect of the fiduciary duty rule.
Their findings are quite remarkable. The researchers show that the offering yields on negotiated bonds decreased by around 10.6 basis points, or about 8.7%, relative to competitively bid bonds after the implementation of the fiduciary duty rule.
Wow, that's a significant reduction in borrowing costs for municipal issuers. Can you walk us through the mechanism behind this result?
Absolutely. The researchers dig deeper and find that the lower offering yields are driven by reduced underwriting spreads on negotiated bonds. With advisors now bound by fiduciary duty, they are more likely to negotiate higher prices or lower yields for their clients, the municipal issuers.
That makes a lot of sense. By aligning the interests of advisors and issuers, the fiduciary duty rule seems to have helped issuers get better pricing on their bond offerings. But the researchers also find some interesting heterogeneity in the results.
Yes, that's right. The paper shows that the benefits of the fiduciary duty rule are primarily enjoyed by larger and more sophisticated municipal issuers. These issuers are more likely to engage advisors after the rule and experience greater reductions in their offering yields.
On the other hand, the researchers find that smaller issuers who relied on advisors that ultimately exited the market after the rule faced higher borrowing costs. It seems the fixed costs associated with the new regulation may have posed a burden for some advisory firms, leading to their withdrawal from the market.
That's a really important point. While the overall effect of the fiduciary duty rule was positive for municipal borrowers, there was significant heterogeneity based on the size and sophistication of the issuers. Larger, more resourceful issuers were able to capitalize on the benefits, while smaller issuers faced challenges.
And interestingly, the researchers also uncovered some insights related to municipal advisor fees. Through painstaking data collection efforts, they were able to obtain information on advisor fees across several states. Surprisingly, they find that the average advising fees paid by issuers did not increase after the regulation.
That's a really important finding. It suggests that the fiduciary duty rule was effective in mitigating the potential for excessive fees, while still delivering lower borrowing costs for municipal issuers on average.
Absolutely. This paper provides a comprehensive and nuanced analysis of a critical issue in the municipal bond market. By leveraging a clever research design and novel data sources, the authors are able to uncover important insights about the impact of fiduciary duty on municipal bond issuance.
I found the researchers' approach to be particularly impressive. By comparing negotiated and competitively bid bonds, they were able to isolate the effect of the fiduciary duty rule and rule out alternative explanations. And the heterogeneity analysis, looking at issuer size and advisor exits, really helps us understand the broader implications.
Agreed. This paper is a great example of how rigorous, data-driven research can shed light on real-world policy issues. The findings have important implications for municipal issuers, financial advisors, and policymakers alike.
Absolutely. The paper not only provides empirical evidence on the effects of the fiduciary duty rule, but also highlights the complexities and nuances involved in regulating financial markets. It's a fantastic contribution to the literature on municipal finance and the role of financial intermediaries.
Definitely. This study is a must-read for anyone interested in understanding the dynamics of the municipal bond market and the impact of regulations on financial intermediaries. The researchers have done an excellent job of blending expert analysis with compelling storytelling to illuminate a critical issue.
Well said, Jen. This was a fascinating deep dive into a really important piece of research. I'm sure our listeners have a much richer understanding of fiduciary duty and its implications for the municipal bond market after this episode.
Absolutely. Thank you all for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this exploration of the research paper Fiduciary Duty in the Municipal Bonds Market. Be sure to check out our other episodes, where we dive into more cutting-edge discoveries across a wide range of fields.
Until next time, keep exploring. Are your municipal bond advisor fees too high? Are you tired of being taken advantage of by financial intermediaries?
Then you need Honest Abe's Municipal Bonds. We're the financial advisors with a heart of gold and a commitment to fiduciary duty.
That's right, folks. At Honest Abe's, we'll always put your interests first. No more conflicts of interest, no more hidden fees, just honest, transparent advice to save you money.
How do we do it? Simple. Our team of Abraham Lincoln lookalikes will negotiate your bond offerings like their life depends on it. With their uncanny resemblance and uncompromising integrity, you'll get the best deal in town.
That's Honest Abe's Municipal Bonds. We'll save you money while keeping your bond advisor's hat firmly on their head. Call 1-800-LINCOLN-BONDS today.
Honest Abe's Municipal Bonds. Because your taxpayers deserve honest finance.
Welcome to The Cutting Edge, the podcast that takes a deep dive into the latest groundbreaking research. I'm Tom, here with my co-host Jane.
Hi everyone. Today, we're excited to discuss a fascinating paper that explores how lessons from model risk management in financial institutions could be applied to improve the quality of academic research. The paper is titled Lessons from Model Risk Management in Financial Institutions for Academic Research and it's authored by Mahmoud Alekmandan and Olga Strelchenko.
This is a really intriguing topic. As we know, academic research is the foundation for advancing our knowledge across disciplines, but there have been some concerning issues in recent years, like allegations of misconduct and erroneous results. The authors argue that by adopting principles from model risk management in finance, academic institutions could strengthen their research practices and prevent such problems.
Absolutely. The core premise is that both academic research and financial modeling rely on quantitative models to derive insights and make decisions. And just like in finance, these models in academia come with their own set of limitations and risks that need to be carefully managed.
That's a great point. The authors define a model as a quantitative representation of the essential structure of some relationship, object or event used to emulate current reality and or project potential future outcomes. They note that while this applies to the data-driven, inductive research fields, it doesn't necessarily extend to more deductive disciplines like abstract mathematics or theoretical physics.
Right, the focus here is on the kind of academic research that is grounded in real-world data and empirical observations. The authors argue that these data-driven projects are particularly susceptible to bias and error, much like the models used in financial institutions.
Exactly. In finance, models are used for critical decision-making across the industry, from assessing credit risk to detecting fraud. And because these models simplify reality, there's inherent model risk that can lead to financial, legal, and reputational losses if not properly managed.
The authors draw an insightful parallel between the model life cycle in finance and Thomas Kuhn's famous cycle of scientific revolutions. Just as Kuhn described how scientific paradigms evolve over time, the authors say financial models go through a similar progression, moving from initial development to widespread acceptance and eventual replacement by newer models.
That's a really clever connection. The authors use this analogy to establish a foundation for understanding how model risk management practices in finance could translate to the academic context. They then outline three core principles of model risk governance that they believe should be adopted in academia.
The first principle is model ownership. In finance, there is a clear assignment of responsibility, with a designated model owner who is accountable for a model's development, implementation, and ongoing performance. The authors propose a similar role for academic research projects.
Absolutely, model ownership is key. The model owner would be responsible for things like documenting the model's assumptions, limitations, and intended use, which brings us to the second principle, documentation.
That's right. In finance, comprehensive documentation is a crucial tool for managing model risk. It captures the model's entire life cycle, from initial design to validation and monitoring. The authors argue academic research should follow a similar documentation process to ensure transparency and accountability.
And the third core principle is effective challenge. In the financial sector, this involves independent review and critique of models by parties outside the model development team. The authors suggest academic institutions should implement similar practices, like peer review, to identify potential flaws or biases in research studies.
These three principles, model ownership, documentation, and effective challenge, form the backbone of the author's proposed framework for improving the quality of academic research. By adopting these practices, the authors believe universities and research institutions could mitigate the risks of erroneous results and even prevent instances of academic misconduct.
It's a really compelling argument. The authors draw clear parallels between the model risk challenges in finance and the issues that have plagued some areas of academic research. Implementing a structured model governance approach could go a long way in strengthening the integrity and reliability of scholarly work.
Absolutely. One of the key points the authors make is that model risk management isn't just about technical model validation. It's also about establishing clear roles, responsibilities, and accountability. This aligns perfectly with some of the systemic problems we've seen in academia, where a lack of oversight and diffusion of responsibility can contribute to sloppy research practices or even outright fraud.
That's a great observation. The authors really drive home the importance of having a designated model owner who is empowered and accountable for the entire life cycle of a research project. This level of ownership and responsibility is often lacking in academic settings, where researchers may work in silos or shift blame when things go wrong.
Exactly. And the documentation piece is crucial too. By documenting the assumptions, limitations, and intended use of their models and research methods, academics would be forced to confront potential weaknesses and biases upfront. This transparency could go a long way in enhancing the credibility of their work.
And the effective challenge component is key as well. Peer review is already a cornerstone of academia, but the authors suggest taking it even further, with truly independent critiques that go beyond just checking for technical errors. This kind of rigorous, outside scrutiny could uncover blind spots and uncover issues that the researchers themselves may have missed.
Absolutely. Implementing these three principles of model risk management could transform the research culture in academia, making it more accountable, transparent, and self-correcting. It's a fascinating idea, and one that could have profound implications for how we approach knowledge production and discovery in the ivory tower.
I couldn't agree more. This paper provides a really innovative and holistic framework for addressing some of the long-standing challenges in academic research. By borrowing from the financial sector's hard-won lessons on model risk, universities and research institutions could instill a new level of rigor and integrity in their work.
Definitely. And I think the timing of this paper is particularly relevant, given the growing concerns around research misconduct and the replication crisis in certain fields. Adopting a model risk management approach could be a game changer in restoring public trust in academic research.
Absolutely. This is such an important conversation, and I'm grateful the authors have brought these ideas to the forefront. It's a testament to their own depth of experience, spanning both academia and the financial sector. Their unique cross-pollination of ideas is really quite brilliant.
I couldn't agree more. This paper has really opened my eyes to the potential benefits of applying model risk management principles in the academic context. It's a fascinating intersection of two worlds that don't often overlap, but clearly have a lot to learn from one another. I'm excited to see how these ideas might take root and transform the research landscape in the years to come.
Same here. This has been a truly enlightening discussion, and I'm sure our listeners are just as captivated by the insights from this paper as we are. It's a great example of how we can take cutting-edge research from one domain and apply it to tackle challenges in a completely different context. That's the power of interdisciplinary thinking at its finest.
Absolutely. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of The Cutting Edge. Thank you all for joining us as we dive into this fascinating research on model risk management and its potential applications in academia. Be sure to subscribe and tune in next time as we explore another groundbreaking study that's pushing the boundaries of knowledge. Until then, keep exploring the frontiers of science.
Thanks, everyone. Take care. A jingle plays, upbeat yet slightly off-kilter asterisk.
Are you tired of academic research that's more like a house of cards than a solid foundation of knowledge?
Introducing time manipulation gadgets, the solution to your model risk management woes.
With our patented time-bending technology, you can rewind, pause, and slow down your research models to uncover hidden biases and errors.
Never again be caught off guard by that pesky replication crisis. Time manipulation gadgets have you covered.
And for a limited time, we'll throw in our flagship product, the reverse entropy device. Instantly undo years of academic entropy with the push of a button.
So what are you waiting for? Get your time manipulation gadgets today and start producing research that stands the test of time.
Time manipulation gadgets. Because your models deserve more than a wing and a prayer. Asterisk, the jingle fades out with a shimmer of distorted time.
Welcome to our podcast, where we dive deep into the fascinating world of cutting-edge research. I'm Tom, and joining me today is my co-host, Jane.
Hello everyone. We're thrilled to explore a paper that investigates the impact of data breach disclosure laws, a critical issue in our increasingly digital world.
The paper we'll be discussing today is titled Sound and Fury, Signifying Nothing? Impact of Data Breach Disclosure Laws. It's authored by Mohammed Zia Haidari, Yangfan Liang, and Rahul Telang.
This is a fascinating study that challenges the long-held assumption that data breach disclosure laws effectively compel companies to improve their cybersecurity practices. The researchers take a close look at the purported primary mechanism behind these laws, the fear of losing customer revenue.
Exactly. Data breach disclosure laws require companies to notify customers when their personal information has been compromised. The idea is that this will incentivize firms to bolster their security measures to avoid the reputational and financial damage that could result from a data breach.
But the researchers question whether this mechanism truly plays out in the real world. To investigate this, they analyze the impact of a massive data breach that occurred at the home improvement retailer, Home Depot, in 2014.
That's right. Home Depot experienced one of the largest data breaches in history at the time, with hackers stealing the payment card information of 56 million customers. This provided the perfect natural experiment for the researchers to study.
The researchers had access to a unique dataset, transaction-level data from one of the largest U.S. banks covering 302 Home Depot stores across several states. This gave them a granular view of sales and customer traffic before and after the data breach disclosure.
Fascinating. So, how did the researchers design their study to isolate the impact of the data breach disclosure on Home Depot's revenue?
Well, they couldn't simply compare Home Depot stores before and after the breach, as that would be confounded by seasonal trends and other factors. Instead, they came up with a clever identification strategy.
Go on, I'm intrigued.
The key insight was that the competitive landscape faced by each Home Depot store mattered a lot. Stores that had a Lowe's store nearby were likely to face more customer substitution if Home Depot customers were angered by the data breach. Meanwhile, Home Depot stores without a nearby Lowe's were essentially monopolies in their local markets.
I see. So the researchers used the presence of a competing Lowe's store within a certain radius as a way to classify Home Depot stores into a treatment group and a control group. Brilliant.
Exactly. The researchers designated Home Depot stores with a Lowe's within 3 miles as the treatment group, while stores without a nearby Lowe's were the control group. This allowed them to use a difference-in-difference design to isolate the impact of the data breach disclosure.
And what did they find?
Contrary to the theoretical predictions, the researchers found absolutely no evidence of a decline in revenue at the Home Depot stores, either in the aggregate or when examining stores by their prior revenue size.
Wow, that's really surprising. So the primary mechanism underlying data breach disclosure laws, the fear of customer punishment and revenue loss, doesn't seem to be playing out in reality.
Precisely. The researchers conclude that this casts serious doubt on the effectiveness of these data breach disclosure laws. If firms don't face tangible revenue consequences, they have little incentive to improve their cybersecurity practices.
This is a fascinating finding. I can imagine the implications for policymakers and firms alike. What do the researchers suggest as potential alternatives or supplements to these disclosure laws?
They argue that policymakers should consider other strategies, such as ex-ante regulations that mandate specific cybersecurity standards, or stronger legal frameworks to hold firms accountable for data breaches. The researchers also note that the lack of a revenue impact raises questions about whether data breach disclosure laws are merely sound and fury, signifying nothing.
That's a powerful metaphor. It really drives home the idea that these laws may be ineffective at driving the intended behavioral changes. This study certainly challenges some long-held assumptions in the field.
Absolutely. The researchers are calling for more empirical research to understand the true mechanisms and impacts of data breach disclosure laws. As they point out, the problem of data breaches is far from solved, and policymakers need to find more effective ways to incentivize firms to prioritize cybersecurity.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. Data breaches and cybersecurity are such critical issues in our increasingly digital world, so it's important to rigorously examine the policies and assumptions that govern this space.
I couldn't agree more. This paper really pushes us to think more critically about the unintended consequences and limitations of well-intentioned regulations. It's a great reminder that we need to continuously evaluate and evolve our approaches to complex societal problems.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jen, for helping unpack this thought-provoking research. And thank you, listeners, for joining us on this journey. We'll catch you next time on the podcast.
Until then, keep thinking critically and curiously about the world around you. Goodbye for now.
Are you tired of the constant threat of data breaches hanging over your head? Worried about the impact a breach could have on your business?
Well, Have we got the solution for you? Introducing Cyber Bodyguards, the premier cybersecurity firm that will have your back like a sumo wrestler.
That's right, folks. Our team of elite ex-hacker ninjas will protect your data fortress with an impenetrable force field of encryption, firewalls, and extreme glaring.
Need to fend off a ransomware attack? Our cyber bodyguards will personally wrestle that malware into submission and toss it out on its digital rear end.
And the best part? Our services are completely unaffected by those pesky data breach disclosure laws. Because when it comes to your data, the only thing that's getting disclosed is the size of our biceps.
So don't settle for cybersecurity that's all talk and no action. Call Cyber Bodyguards today and let our hulking experts safeguard your digital empire. Operators are standing by, so get ready to flex your security muscles.
Cyber Bodyguards, we've got your back. Literally. Welcome listeners to the Cutting Edge Research Podcast. I'm Tom, and with me is my co-host Jane. Today, we are diving into a fascinating research paper that explores how to identify the effects of fiscal policy in small open economies. The paper is titled Identification of Fiscal SVARIVS in Small Open Economies, and it was written by Henry Kerenen and Sakari Lademaki.
This is really exciting work that tackles a long-standing challenge in empirical macroeconomics: how to credibly identify the dynamic causal effects of fiscal policy shocks. The researchers propose a novel instrumental variable that they argue can help solve this identification problem, especially for small open economies. Let's dig into the details.
The key research question the authors are addressing is how effective fiscal policy is in stimulating the economy, particularly in small open economies. As they note, much of the existing literature on fiscal multipliers has focused on larger economies like the US. But the effects of fiscal policy can differ quite a bit in smaller, more open economies due to factors like exchange rate regimes and monetary policy.
Exactly. The researchers wanted to study fiscal policy in two distinct types of small open economies: Canada, which has a flexible exchange rate and independent monetary policy, and a group of small euro area countries, which operate under a fixed exchange rate and exogenous monetary policy from the European Central Bank. Comparing these two settings can shed light on how the economic institutions in place might influence the potency of fiscal stimulus.
To identify the effects of fiscal policy, the researchers use a structural vector autoregression, SVAR, framework, which allows them to separate the systematic component of fiscal policy from the actual fiscal shocks. But a key challenge in SVAR models is finding a valid instrument to identify these shocks.
This is where the researchers' main contribution comes in. They propose using professional forecast errors of trading partner economies as an instrument for domestic output shocks. The logic is that these forecast errors should be correlated with unexpected movements in the small open economy's GDP, but uncorrelated with that country's own fiscal policy shocks.
That's a really clever idea. By tapping into information from trading partners, the researchers can find variation in domestic output that is exogenous to the focal country's fiscal policy. This helps overcome the classic identification problem where fiscal variables may endogenously respond to changes in output.
Absolutely. The researchers show that this trading partner forecast error instrument is indeed highly relevant. It has strong predictive power for the unexpected component of domestic GDP. And through a series of tests, they also provide evidence supporting the exogeneity assumption, showing that the instrument is uncorrelated with proxies for the small open economy's own fiscal shocks.
That's great. So with this new instrument in hand, how do the researchers use it to estimate the effects of fiscal policy?
They embed the instrument in a SVAR framework, using it to identify the systematic component of fiscal policy. Specifically, they estimate the output elasticity of government spending, which is a key parameter that determines how much of the observed co-movement between spending and output is due to policy shocks versus automatic stabilizers.
I see. And how does this compare to the typical Blanchard-Perotti identification, which imposes a zero restriction on that output elasticity?
That's a really important point. The researchers find that even small deviations from that zero restriction can lead to large differences in the estimated spending multipliers. Their baseline estimates, using the unconstrained CK identification, put the two-year cumulative spending multiplier at around 1 for Canada and 0.5 for the euro area small open economies.
Interesting. So the multiplier seems to be higher in Canada compared to the euro area countries, despite the standard Mundell-Fleming framework predicting the opposite. What might explain that finding?
The researchers suggest a few potential reasons. It could be that Canada has smaller import leakages, or that its monetary policy doesn't work to fully offset the stimulative effects of fiscal expansion. They also find that revenue-side stimulus appears less impactful than spending-side for both Canada and the euro area, potentially because revenue shocks have less persistent effects on the budget deficit.
Got it. And the researchers also look at the broader macroeconomic dynamics beyond just the output effects. What did they find there?
Well, the impulse responses reveal some interesting patterns. For Canada, they find evidence consistent with the twin deficits hypothesis. Expansionary fiscal policy leads to both higher budget deficits and current account deficits. This suggests fiscal stimulus spills over to higher imports and capital inflows.
That's a fascinating result. And how about the euro area small open economies? Do they show a similar twin deficits dynamic?
The results are a bit more mixed for the euro area countries. While there is some evidence supporting the twin deficits, the responses of the current account and budget balance are not as clear-cut as for Canada. The researchers note that this could be driven by the distinctive dynamics of one country in their sample, Portugal.
Interesting. So the heterogeneity across these small open economies is an important consideration. Overall, what do you think are the key takeaways from this research?
I think the main takeaways are twofold. First, the researchers show that using a novel instrument like trading partner forecast errors can help overcome long-standing identification challenges in fiscal SVAR models, especially for small open economies. And second, their findings suggest that the effects of fiscal policy can vary quite a bit across different types of small open economies, depending on factors like the exchange rate regime and monetary policy.
Absolutely. This study really highlights the importance of going beyond the standard closed economy fiscal SVAR framework and accounting for the unique features of open economies. It also demonstrates the value of creative identification strategies that move beyond traditional timing or signed restrictions.
Definitely. The researchers have made a valuable contribution by shedding new light on the fiscal policy transmission mechanism in small open economies. Their work opens up interesting avenues for future research, like exploring potential spillover effects across countries or digging deeper into the sources of heterogeneity they uncover.
Well said. This was a really fascinating discussion of an insightful and impactful piece of research. Thanks for joining me today, Jane. I'm sure our listeners have a much richer understanding of how to identify the effects of fiscal policy now.
My pleasure, Tom. This was a great opportunity to dive into the complexities of fiscal SVAR modeling and highlight the innovative approaches researchers are using to advance our knowledge in this important area of macroeconomics. I'm sure our audience is as intrigued as we are to see where this line of research goes next.
Absolutely. Thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Cutting Edge Research. And now a word from our sponsor.
Are you a small, open economy struggling to understand the effects of your fiscal policy? Well, have we got the solution for you? Introducing
Fiscal SVARIVSRS.
That's right. We're the one-stop shop for all your fiscal policy identification needs. Tired of those pesky Blanchard-Parotti restrictions cramping your SVAR style?
Just let our team of expert econometricians work their magic with our patented trading partner forecast error instrument. It's the secret sauce that'll have your fiscal multipliers singing.
Need to figure out if your government spending is leaking out through the current account? Wonder no more with Fiscal SVAIV's RS.
Our cutting-edge analysis will separate the systematic from the shocky, the input from the output, the twins from the deficits. All for the low, low price of 3 easy payments of $19.95.
So what are you waiting for, small open economy? Head to fiscalsvarovsa.us.com and let us work our econometric voodoo. Your GDP will thank you.
Fiscal SVAIVSRS, identifying the causal effects of your fiscal policy, no matter how open your economy may be.
This message brought to you by the cutting-edge researchers behind the paper Identification of Fiscal SVARIVs in Small Open Economies. Because your fiscal multiplier is our business.
Welcome to the Research Rundown, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of cutting-edge academic discoveries. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host Jane.
Hi everyone. Today we're diving into a fascinating paper that explores a novel policy approach to tackling one of the biggest challenges in the energy transition, phasing out coal.
The title of the paper we'll be discussing is The Economics of Coal Phase-Outs, Auctions as a Novel Policy Instrument for the Energy Transition, authored by Sugandha Srivastava and Michael Zeiringer.
This is a really timely and important topic. Coal remains the world's dirtiest and most polluting source of energy, responsible for around 40% of annual emissions from energy and industry. With the urgent need to limit global temperature rise, many countries have put in place targets to phase out coal entirely. But how do you actually make that happen in practice?
That's where this research comes in. The authors argue that traditional policy approaches like carbon pricing often fall short, with prices remaining too low to drive the rapid transition away from coal that's required. So they explore auctions as an alternative policy instrument that could help facilitate the early retirement of coal-fired power plants in a more efficient and transparent way.
Fascinating. So the key idea is that rather than relying on negotiations between governments and coal plant owners, which can suffer from information asymmetry, auctions could discover the true cost of early closure and allocate compensation more effectively.
Exactly. The paper uses Germany's experience with coal phase-out auctions as a case study to analyze the merits and drawbacks of this approach. As Jen mentioned, Germany is actually the only country so far to have implemented a nationwide coal phase-out auction.
I'm really curious to learn more about how that worked in practice. What were some of the key design considerations, and what can we learn from Germany's experience?
Well, one of the big challenges the authors highlight is ensuring additionality. In other words, making sure the emission reductions from coal plant closures are truly additional and not just displacing emissions elsewhere. The researchers note that with a negotiated approach, it can be hard to tell if the coal plants were going to close down anyway due to economic pressures.
That's a really good point. An auction process in theory should help reveal the true opportunity cost of early closure, as plant owners will have an incentive to bid their actual closure costs rather than inflating them. But the paper raises some interesting nuances around how the auction design needs to be carefully structured to achieve that.
Absolutely. For example, they note that if the lead time for decommissioning is too short, the auction may end up just compensating plants that were already planning to shut down. And there are also concerns about the interaction with other climate policies, like the EU emissions trading scheme, where closing coal plants could actually lead to a waterbed effect and increased emissions elsewhere.
Wow, it's clearly a complex policy challenge with a lot of moving parts. The paper also dives into the importance of considering dynamic incentives and system-wide effects. Can you tell us more about what they mean by that?
Sure. One key dynamic incentive issue is that with a staggered phase-out approach, where the auctions happen over multiple rounds, there could be strategic gaming by coal plant owners around which round they choose to participate in. The researchers suggest ways the auction design can be tweaked to discourage this, like decreasing the maximum compensation over time.
That makes a lot of sense. And on the system-wide effects, the paper highlights how the closure of certain coal plants could have unintended impacts on things like grid stability and congestion management that need to be accounted for. I imagine that adds another layer of complexity to designing an efficient auction process.
Definitely. The authors use the German experience to illustrate how the auction design had to be adjusted to prevent the premature closure of critical assets for system reliability. Things like applying penalties to bids from plants deemed essential for grid stability.
It's clear a lot of careful thought has to go into structuring these coal phase-out auctions to get the incentives right and avoid unintended consequences. And as you mentioned, Germany is really the only case study we have to learn from so far. Do the authors discuss the broader applicability of this approach beyond the German context?
Yes, they do explore when auctions might be the right policy tool versus other alternatives. The key seems to be the degree of competition and diversity in coal plant ownership. Where ownership is highly concentrated, they suggest incentives for scrappage or repurposing of assets may be more appropriate than auctions.
That makes sense. And the paper also touches on the political economy considerations around compensation versus more punitive measures like carbon pricing. Can you tell us a bit more about that angle?
Absolutely. The authors note that while carbon pricing is theoretically the optimal approach, it often faces challenges in the real world, particularly in developing countries with rigid electricity markets dominated by long-term contracts. In those contexts, a pay-to-break mechanism like compensation for early coal closure may be more politically feasible.
That's a really insightful point. Sometimes the perfect can be the enemy of the good, and policymakers have to be pragmatic in finding solutions that can actually gain traction. Compensating coal plant owners for early retirement, even if not the first best policy, may be an important stepping stone towards the clean energy transition.
Exactly. The paper does a great job of highlighting the trade-offs and emphasizing that in a second best world, we need to consider a portfolio of policy instruments, not just rely on a single approach like carbon pricing. Auctions for coal plant closures can play a valuable role, even if they require careful design to unlock their full benefits.
This has been a really fascinating deep dive into an innovative policy solution to a critical climate challenge. I'm impressed by the nuanced way the authors have analyzed the pros and cons, drawing key lessons from the pioneering example of Germany. It's a great example of how academic research can uncover new pathways for real-world policymaking.
Absolutely. This is the kind of work that can really move the needle in accelerating the clean energy transition. By exploring alternative approaches and rigorously evaluating their implementation, researchers are helping policymakers navigate the complex trade-offs involved. It's exciting to see innovative ideas like this coming to the fore.
Definitely. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us on the Research Rundown. I'm sure our listeners have a much deeper understanding of the economics of coal phase-outs and the potential role of auctions as a policy tool. Until next time, keep exploring the frontiers of discovery.
Thanks everyone, talk to you soon. Jingle plays asterisk.
Are you a coal plant owner struggling with the hassle of early retirement? Introducing Coal Exit, the one-stop shop for all your coal phase-out needs.
Tired of negotiating with pesky government officials over compensation? Our auction experts will handle everything, ensuring you get the maximum payout for shutting down that dirty old plant.
Worried about the impact on grid stability? Coal Exit's advanced algorithms will find the perfect balance, allowing you to close down without leaving your region in the dark.
And with our patented emissions offset program, you can even turn a profit by selling your excess carbon credits. It's a win-win for you and the planet.
So what are you waiting for? Call 1-800-COAL-BUY to speak with a Coal Exit specialist today. Phasing out has never been easier.
Coal Exit, taking the pain out of the energy transition. Jingle plays asterisk.